Well, folks, welcome to the last day of the Trump administration. It's been a long ride, an interesting ride, something I never thought would happen in my lifetime. Indeed, I had consigned politics to the area of my life where I keep all of the boring things that don't really impact my actual life and really just more or less take place on TV. But the Trump era has completely changed that, and now we're all engaged, we're all involved. So let's talk about what happened, what's going on now, and what the implications of all this are for the future. I'm Patrick Cunningham, and this is Socratic Citizen. So we talked yesterday about religion, and that's always a ripe topic for discussion. So as usual, I want to start off the show by talking about something that either someone sent me or someone mentioned in the chat or something that just went on so we can kind of have some continuity and build a sense of an ongoing discussion here about all the things that affect our lives from a social, political, and philosophical direction. And in pursuit of that, I'd like to talk about American evangelicals, specifically the comment yesterday that said the left needs to embrace the religious people or people of faith in the United States. So I did a little bit of reading last night about progressive evangelicals. As it turns out, they do exist, and I would guess from my reading that they make up about 15, maybe 18% of the evangelical population. They are very Christian, as are most evangelicals, in fact, but they do not go in for the talk of abortion is murder. They do not go in for really any of the things that normally characterize evangelicals. Indeed, outside of their deep commitment to their Christian faith, at least their nominal Christian faith, they really shared nothing in common with the religious right as we've understood the religious right since the Reagan administration. And that's another interesting thing about this, that the religious right is actually a relatively recent phenomenon, that historically, religious people have tended to fall on the left. At least those who took their convictions seriously, as opposed to those who merely attended church, but then as soon as they left the church house, went right back to doing things the way they wanted to do them anyway. So we have a long history in the United States of, for example, evangelical abolitionists, for example, religious civil rights leaders, so on and so forth. If we equate the left with any notion of progress in the United States, which I realize is a controversial claim, but insofar as the left ascribes to itself the mantle of progress, we can say that historically Christianity has been on the side of that progress. And really only in recent years, only in the past 30 to 40 years, has religion become associated with conservative politics or politics that looks askance at ideas of progress and is more inclined to leave things as they are out of a sense of prudence than to go tearing up all the institutions and traditions of society in the name of some better ideal just over the hill. So I found actually, so thank you for this, Public Citizen was actually the comment in concert with a couple other people who brought me to this question, so I have you to thank for me finding the magazine Sojourners, which is a progressive evangelical magazine. And here they are, but they're not my only source because obviously they're a little biased, but they argue that white American Christianity is a bubble and it's about to burst. Now, this is from 2017, so it's from the early part of the Trump presidency. So, like I said before, we're just going to have to keep in mind that anything that's happened over the last 4 years can't really be indicative of any huge trends. Really, the best argument is to say that whatever's happened over the last 4 years has rather been the bringing to the forefront of already latent trends in American culture and politics. So I think that whatever is said in here is likely to remain true today. So let's take a look at what's in here about white American evangelical Christianity and we'll see if there's really any hope for the left to ever embrace religious people, and if they did, what would that look like? So last Friday, this is last Friday in, I think, mid-2017, Jerry Falwell Jr. took to Fox News to proclaim that in Donald Trump, quote, evangelicals have found their dream president. 2 years ago, aka 2015, this statement would have made virtually no sense, at least on the surface. Too many outside the evangelical world, it seemed, and still seems inconceivable that a thrice married serial adulterer, ultimate materialist, casino owner, habitual liar, and unprincipled dealmaker could have ever become the standard bearer for a group that professes to base their vote on, quote, family values. I must confess, I too was a little confused by evangelical support for Trump, and I could only ascribe it to the fact that I think evangelicals feel largely as if they have been pushed out of the mainstream, specifically by the fall in church attendance and identification with the Christian faith that has taken place in virtually every part of American life outside of the evangelical world. One could argue, indeed, that since the 80s, evangelicals have turned to the right and have turned to conservatism because they feel that this mantle of progress has been taken by people who are not so circumspect about their desire to take the United States past a religious orientation and into some kind of post-religious future. So how the times have changed, the article says. In the 2 years since Trump announced his candidacy, we have seen a remarkable moral unmasking of white Americans who call themselves Christian. I should say, this largely talks about white people, as the headline would suggest. But we should not forget that within black churches, for example, there is still a lot of antipathy towards, for example, LGBTQIA2S plus stuff, that they are really not on board with a lot of the progressive agenda, and that outside of their stubborn insistence on continuing to vote Democrat, they really look and sound a lot more like Republicans to a broad extent, especially when it comes to issues of sexual morality. Things like abortion and gay rights do not get a ton of an audience in traditionalist black church culture. So, where was I? 81% of white evangelical voters cast their vote for Donald Trump. And the most recent Pew Research poll puts Trump's support after his first 100 days in office at 78% among white evangelicals, 80% among white evangelicals who attend church once a month. So it makes sense that Falwell would be asked to rate the president on his first 100 days in office from an evangelical perspective. Falwell was essentially a surrogate for Trump during much of the campaign. And in late January, Trump asked Falwell to lead a task force on higher education policy, whose aim is to recommend changes that should be made to Department of Education policies and procedures. So he has indicated in particular that he wants to curb or eliminate federal rules that he views as overly burdensome, including the requirement that schools must investigate campus sexual assault under Title IX, a federal law banning discrimination in education. So this is something of a side note, but I have to say that it doesn't quite make sense to investigate campus sexual assault under anti-discrimination laws. It would make more sense to investigate them under, you know, anti-assault laws or rape laws, you know, the laws that we have in place to prevent this sort of thing, rather than trying to turn it into a civil rights issue. However, that's really neither here nor there, because I know that that's not the argument that Jerry Falwell and his ilk are using. Indeed, they say, oh, you know, laying the legal and rules-based framework for sexual looseness, to borrow their phraseology, is really just going to promote more of it. And our rules should reflect the sexual morality that we want our college students to have, which is a conscientious chastity until marriage kind of approach. So here are some of the claims Falwell made for why Trump is a dream president for evangelicals. And of course, this will be germane to anyone who wants to see the left try to embrace religious people, as we had, which we're talking about yesterday. So Trump is more pro-Israel than Obama. Trump is indeed very pro-Israel. He moved the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He appointed Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. He has appointed people of faith to his cabinet. Mike Pence, indeed, has shown a truly Jesus-like tolerance for Trump and managed to hold it together rock-like in the face of all this. Trump will destroy ISIS, thereby saving the lives of many persecuted Christians in the region. This seems like a bit of tortured logic there. Sounds like using Christianity to justify your desire to do imperialistic stuff. But we'll get to imperialism later when we talk about the title of this episode. Trump supports secure borders, e.g. the wall. We know Christians are all about walls. A little more tortured logic there. You can be in favor of a wall. You can be in favor of strict immigration policy. But I don't know that you can really find justification for it in the Bible, of all places. Trump is bringing jobs back to America. And Trump is cracking down on sanctuary cities. Really, this goes in the same category as the wall. Now, Falwell made a point to note that he felt evangelicals didn't just vote on social issues this time, because the Republican establishment had lied to them over decades about those issues. And so, instead, they went a different direction, which was his explanation for why so many white evangelicals are thrilled about Trump's hardline positions on immigration, if I can remember the ins and outs of the English language. So I think this, really the key right here is the Republican establishment lied to them over decades. So on the one hand, we have what appears to be an evangelical mindset that really does not lend itself to left-wing politics at all. On the other hand, we have an evangelical establishment that is extremely frustrated with the Republican establishment. So perhaps they might be ripe for receiving overtures from the left, if the left can kind of drop some of its more aggressive sexual stuff. I think that might be one of the really the main things driving the evangelicals to the right these days. The post-sexual revolution, it's much harder to make the case, oh, Christians really should be on the left. There's no other place for them, because they're going, well, time out. My religion teaches abstinence till marriage. Marriage is the only appropriate place for sexual activity. I mean, you can even work in homosexuality to that one. You can even say, look, you can be gay, but you still got to be chaste and you still got to be monogamous. So I don't really see a lot of that from the left right now. But of course, Time Magazine was happy to come along and shatter all of my preconceived notions on this question. And this is why the young religious right is leaning left. This one is from, I believe, 2018. So Alicia Crosby, because Time Magazine has to start everything with a fun story. So Alicia Crosby stood at the edge of a strobe lit dance floor as Kelly Clarkson's People Like Us thumped through the speakers during Pride Weekend in New York City in 2013. Like many millennial evangelicals, Alicia, an African-American, had grown up in a world riven by the culture wars. A few years earlier, she had called a lesbian Christian friend an abomination, which is not nice, frankly. Then she heard the long version of her friend's story, one of feeling torn between her faith and her sexuality. Her friend's words filled Alicia with empathy and motivated her to attend this Pride party. As she watched the crowd thrash to Clarkson's dedication to the lost and forgotten, Alicia said that she realized that they were, quote, dancing their truth. Jerry's Woodshop says they're leaning left because they've been brainwashed since birth. We will read all the comments and respond to them momentarily. I'm trying to get out of the habit of reflex reading the comments, which is what I did before. We're trying to have a more organized show here. So we'll get to you, Jerry. Give me just a second here. So, because actually we are getting to the comments here, let me just summarize this. So really what this points out, and it does address the idea of leftist Christianity being kind of a betrayal of Christian ideals, but it points to this group of people who identify as evangelical, who nonetheless embrace left-wing politics and indeed post-sexual revolution politics, and who are inclined to be supportive of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender lifestyles, as focusing less on the sexual morality part of Christianity and more on the help the downtrodden, be nice to the poor, so on and so forth kind of section of Christianity. And so we have here progressive evangelicals, who we are and what we believe. And so really the key to this is these little graphics here. So they talk about the ancient temple, the one where Jesus turned over the tables of the money changers, and they argue that really Jesus was opposed to the idea that the general populace had to stay outside the main walls, the court of the Gentiles was inside the first level of walls, then Jewish women, then Jewish men got the second most inner sanctum, and the most inner sanctum was solely reserved to God. And they're kind of in this article, this Huffington Post article from progressive evangelicals, are saying this is what Jesus was opposed to, not the idea of people selling sacrifices or money changing in the temple, but rather the what they call the inequality inherent in that temple. And so we have their version, or their modernization of this idea, where you have the general populace outside the main walls, then church attendance, then volunteering, then baptism, then giving money. The general populace stays outside. LGBTQ are welcome to attend, but not to volunteer or get baptized. Women are welcome to volunteer. Men are welcome to get baptized, and staff get money. So it's not a perfect analogy, but then we come to this, which is an almost kind of new agey conception of Christianity, where the inner sanctum is in the human heart. I'm inclined to sympathize with this particular graphic, at least, being a bit of a woo-woo spiritualist myself, believing in magic and so on and so forth. I'm just kidding. I don't practice magic. That would be ridiculous. I'm here to do philosophy, not magic. But anyway, last thing, and then we'll read some comments. As long as the Washington Post is taking this tack, I don't think the prospects are good for evangelicals embracing any mainstream movement. They're going to take outsiders like Trump over and over and over again. Washington Post writes, Trump's evangelicals were complicit in the desecration of our democracy. So let's take a look at a couple of comments. So, Jerry's Woodshop says they leaning left because they've been brainwashed since birth. Okay, so this was addressed in the article. They said there's a lot of Christian leaders from the evangelical right, which, let's be clear, is still 80% plus of the evangelical movement, that say, look, basically these people have abandoned Christianity. Christianity has compromised with what the world wants. And so as a result, these people are just embracing what they really want to embrace, which is being cool and sexy and fun and hip, and then kind of grafting Christian ideology over the top of it. Now, of course, I had to go look up sexual morality in the early church as a result of this, because so much of this discussion seems to hinge around moral ideas related to sexuality. It's really like a huge hinge point for this movement. For whatever reason, regardless of what side of the debate you're on, sexuality is the major turning point. And then you have a lot of other issues that I think are much easier to agree on. Like, let's help the poor. We can disagree on the means, but we agree fundamentally on the ends. In the realm of sexual morality, we disagree not only on means, but also on ends. And so I find that in early Christianity, because early Christianity was obviously a much more disorganized place than modern Christianity, with that before the rise of the kind of stable modern sects of Christianity, not the stable modern sects of Christianity, that's different, but you have these people who, a lot of them are part of the Gnostic group, where they talk about their sexual looseness and the kind of a libertinism almost. It kind of falls in line with antinomian Christianity, which, if I remember correctly, is the version of Christianity that preaches that Christians, because of the grace given by the death of Christ on the cross, are exempt from all moral law, and the only injunction given to Christians is to have the Holy Spirit in your heart. In other words, the Spirit gives life, but the letter kills, and therefore let's abandon the letter of the law altogether and follow only the Spirit as it lives within our soul. So, really, the soul of Christianity, insofar as it pertains to sexual politics, has been up for grabs for a long time, and different people are happy to interpret it, it seems, to in whatever way most suits their interests. But hippie Christians with loose sexual morals are nothing new. They've been around for thousands of years. So Fat Daddy Sambo says, are you reading to the bouncing beat of bad disco? What in God's name are you talking about? I have no idea. There is no bouncing beat and no bad disco because disco is dead. So Fat Daddy Sambo also says, what? Did they completely skip Matthew 21:12-13 or Mark 11:15-18? I don't know these verses off the top of my head. The progressives need to read the Bible and accept it as the word of God, instead of continuously attempting to remake the Bible into something that supports their cause of the day. I'm inclined, because I'm always inclined, to bring up Nietzsche and the genealogy of morals and his notion that Christians really took the Christian ideals and molded them to what they wanted to do anyway, which is me bastardizing Nietzsche heavily, but you get the idea. We've been talking for several days about people taking ideas, grafting them onto whatever they wanted to do anyway, and then coming up with tortured logic as to why Christianity or justice or safety or whatever dictates that we have to do the thing that I wanted to do anyway. So one could easily make the argument that on both left and right, there is an element of this. That indeed, many people, Christian and non-Christian, come along and say, well, here's what I kind of feel like is right. Here's what I want to do. I want to have sex with tons of people. So I'm going to find in the Bible where it says that it's okay to break all the rules, and then I'm just going to do what I want. Then somebody else comes along and says, I really want to be like strict and disciplined, and so I'm going to find in the Bible all the stuff that supports my claim. The problem here, I think, is that the Bible is very long, and it's very easy to take things and kind of twist them to fit whatever you wanted. Indeed, I've read arguments before that I'm inclined to agree with, that the Bible is so couched or so covered in layer after layer of interpretation over the top of it that it's very difficult, considering that we live in a society that is at the very least descended from a Christian one, to ascertain for ourselves what the Bible actually says. Because we cannot read it. I think it was Alan Watts who said, you can't read the Bible without hearing some preacher's voice in your head explaining to you what it actually means. And I was lucky enough to come from a largely non-religious background. So when I investigated the Bible, I didn't really have a preacher whispering in my ear, and I came to all sorts of bizarre conclusions as a result. So I've given up largely trying to interpret the Bible, except for in the very broadest of strokes. But what we can say, without question and for the very least, is that the Bible has some very broad injunctions. Care for the poor, don't be a materialist lunatic. Don't store up treasures on earth, store up treasures in heaven, so on and so forth. And a lot of the rest is up to tradition. So maybe we'll trust the Catholics. I don't know. But anyway, let's move on to our second section for a little bit more fun. So this article was all over the place yesterday. I saw a lot of people looking at this and going, what on earth are you talking about? So let's read some of this from the Washington Post and see if we can figure out what on earth they're talking about. So to understand Trump's support, the Washington Post says, we must think in terms of multiracial whiteness. This seems promising. What is multiracial whiteness? So the Trump administration's anti-immigration, anti-civil rights stance has made it easy to classify the president's loyalists as a homogenous mob of white nationalists. And indeed, many of the media have done so. But take a look at the FBI's posters showing people wanted in the insurrectionist assault on the U.S. Capitol. Among the many white faces are a few that are clearly Latino or African American. Indeed, I think that many white conservatives, were a little surprised themselves to find out that Trump had in 2020 increased his support in the Black and Latino communities over 2016, that what was delivered was in fact better than what was promised from their perspective, and that perhaps the repeated accusations that Trump was a fascist and a racist were not quite so based in fact as one might at first have assumed, watching only the mainstream media. Such diversity, the article says, highlights the fact that President Trump's share of the Latino vote in November actually rose over 2016, notwithstanding years of incendiary rhetoric targeting Mexicans and other Latino communities. So the argument I'm making is that this sentence, or this right here, targeting Mexicans and other Latino communities, is incorrect. And that many Latinos saw that it was incorrect, and as a result, they did not feel the kind of antipathy towards Trump that was so typical of the mainstream journalist class. Yes, Trump's voters and his mob are disproportionately white, but one of the more unsettling exit poll data points of the 2020 election was that a quarter to a third of Latino voters voted to re-elect Trump. Now, of course, the argument here is that many Latino communities are very Christian, specifically very Catholic, and they have a very kind of family values-oriented way of looking at things. And Trump, if nothing else, did a great job of positioning himself as a family values candidate, contrary to all surface logic, because he does not seem, in the calm, cool light of the reasoning, to be a very family values-oriented guy with the multiple marriages and the paying porn stars not to talk about their sexual relations and owning casinos and so on and so forth. Not the sort of thing you expect good evangelical Christians to do. But nonetheless, a lot of people did see him this way. And the article says, while the vast majority of Latinos and an overwhelming majority of African-American voters supported the Biden-Harris ticket and were crucial to its success, many Black and brown voters have family and friends who fervently backed the MAGA policy agenda. So we have a couple of examples here of non-white people who supported Trump. And he says, what are we to make of Enrique Tarrio, the head of the Proud Boys and a self-identified Afro-Cuban? What are we to make, they say, of the unmistakably white mob violence? Hello, Xi Jinping. I hope I'm saying that right. We will read comments here shortly. And what are we to make of unmistakably white mob violence that also includes non-white participants? And this is where we get into this concept of multiracial whiteness. The promise that they, too, can lay claim to the politics of aggression, exclusion, and domination. So this is very interesting. What we're starting to see here is a movie, because we had this whole concept of, like, white supremacy, right? And white supremacy used to mean guys with swastika tattoos. Guys who were talking about white ethno-states and neo-segregationists and neo-confederates like people who would walk up to you and say, hi, nice to meet you, I'm a white supremacist, that sort of thing. But it seems the definition has shifted. And now, if you go to the most extreme kind of definitions of it, it's a definition so broad that really anyone who doesn't put on black and join Antifa in the streets is supporting white supremacy. Anyone voting for Trump is supporting white supremacy. So now we have, it's not even really white. It's if you engage in the politics of aggression, exclusion, and domination, you are now part of multiracial whiteness, as white supremacy transmuted into the idea of whiteness as a aggressive, exclusive, and dominating political ideology. And there's actually a part in here where he says this. Multiracial whiteness is an ideology, not a racial identity. So one has to question what it means that a color designation, white, a racial color designation, has been kind of repurposed, much the way, one might argue, progressives have repurposed Bible verses. And repurposing this color race word to refer to a political ideology, I suppose, that's assumed to be the characteristic political ideology of white people, and it's invested in the unequal distribution of land, wealth, power, and privilege. And there's a part in here where they say, actually, the promise of multiracial whiteness is that all people can share in its colorblind individualism, which I thought colorblind individualism was like an ideal. I thought that's what we all wanted. I thought, indeed, that even the anti-racist, pro-discrimination policies of people like Ibram X. Kendi were designed to reach a state of complete equality, or I should say complete equity, because, you know, language nowadays, so on and so forth. But apparently not. Apparently, colorblind individualism is itself a problem. But I don't want to spend the whole time on that. So we have, perhaps in pursuit of fighting against this multiracial whiteness, we have, as Fox News reports, liberal media, big tech, increased calls to deprogram and deplatform Trump supporters. And I have to say, of all the things I've heard over the past few weeks, the word deprogram is the weirdest and the most frightening. Can we just all agree that if you're talking about going around and deprogramming people, that something is up with your vision of the world? So liberal journalists and social media voices have stepped up their calls to deprogram, deplatform, or outright threaten right-leaning voices in the aftermath of the deadly Capitol riot earlier this month. During an appearance Friday on Real Time with Bill Maher, former CBS News anchor Katie Couric ripped the Republicans in Congress who voted against impeaching President Trump over a charge of inciting rioters on January 6th. Quote, "The question is, how are we going to really almost deprogram these people who have signed up for the cult of Trump?" Couric said. Her language mirrored that of liberal Washington Post columnist Eugene Robinson in the aftermath of the riot, when a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol building in a deadly melee. Robinson said last week on MSNBC, quote, "There are millions of Americans, almost all white, almost all Republicans, who somehow need to be deprogrammed." So the only thing scarier than using the word deprogrammed is when a bunch of people all at the same time start using the word deprogrammed. Indeed, as if they themselves have been programmed to say it. So I am concerned about this. You can not like Trump. You can think that Trump, the way people support Trump is bizarre and evidence of some kind of cult-like behavior, perhaps. I don't think so, but you could if you wanted to, and I'd be happy to debate you on it. But as long as you're talking about deprogramming people, you've passed out of the realm of human beings are rational, are capable of reason, are conscious beings unto themselves who can be reasoned with, and they are instead lemmings or computers who can be programmed and deprogrammed at the will of whatever propaganda minister happens to be in the ascendancy at that particular moment. So you've got stuff like this, trying to push anybody who was really a part of the Trump circle out of society altogether. Forbes published an op-ed last week warning companies against hiring anyone who worked in communications for the Trump White House. And of course, everybody knows about this. Trump was banned by everyone from the internet, like, entirely. He is just gone. So CNN's reliable sources on Sunday, or on CNN's reliable sources on Sunday, former Facebook chief security officer Alex Stamos called on big tech and major carriers like Verizon and AT&T to effectively deplatform right-wing outlets in the name of purging misinformation. So it's up to the Facebooks and YouTubes in particular to think about whether or not they want to be effectively cable networks for disinformation, he said, questioning whether cable providers should provide conservative outlets. Essentially, let's deplatform not only conservatives, or I shouldn't say conservatives, right-leaning people from social media, let's push them off of television as well. Think what you want about OAN and Newsmax, but I feel like the answer to bad speech is more speech, to quote whatever Supreme Court justice it was that said that. At least that's my perception. So this is just kind of funny because we can't talk about depressing stuff all the time. So according to the Daily Caller, the Trump baby blimp is to be showcased at a museum as part of its protest collection. So a massive blimp depicting President Donald Trump as an orange baby dressed in a diaper with a cell phone in one hand will be displayed at a London museum as part of its protest collection, numerous sources reported. Trump baby, this is Trump baby. Hi, Trump baby. You see, he's got his little cell phone there. So he reportedly first flew over London in 2018 during protests over Trump's visit to the UK and has since been flown across the globe in France, Argentina, and multiple US cities. Knowing what I know about Trump, this is probably the thing that makes him the most angry. So anyway, so we're coming up on another time for comments here. So just real quick, Parler is at least partially back on the internet with support from a Russian technology firm. So I don't know why it is that the Russian government, well, actually, I do know why it is, but it's weird to see the Russian government becoming kind of the haven for people crushed in the United States. Edward Snowden and Parler both now exist thanks to Russia, which no doubt gives fuel to the fire of those who want to claim that they are just acting on behalf of Russia. But I think is closer, and this is why I think it really happens, is that Russia is happy to do anything that they think makes the U.S. look bad, and so they're happy to support anyone who criticizes the U.S. So really, I think that the fact that Parler and Edward Snowden are supported by Russia, are in Russia, is really a strike against the United States. We're supposed to be capable of hearing criticism. We're supposed to be capable of integrating our critics into our society. That is indeed what is supposed to make American society awesome. So let's bring Edward Snowden home, at the very least. But that's a side thing. So let's read some comments. I see some popping up, so let's take a look at what they are. We have Xi Jinwang. I hope I'm saying that right. Thank you for your service to the Chinese Communist Party, Socratic Citizen. The funds for your services are being transferred to your PayPal account balance now. Long live the CCP. Well, Xi, if you're transferring any money to a PayPal account associated with the name Socratic Citizen, I don't know who you're paying, and I am disappointed to find that the name I was going to use on my PayPal account when I do set one up for this show someday in the future is already taken. So I am sorry to hear that, but you are giving money to someone else. I would also want to inquire what services I have rendered to the Chinese Communist Party. I'm not familiar with them being interested in my analysis of politics and philosophy and talking to people in the chat. But I suppose to the Chinese Communist Party, you're welcome for whatever it was I did. Shelmar says, sorry, but the research shows the reality. A good portion of society do behave like lemmings when they are driven by identity and grievance. All right, so it sounds like you might be taking the discussion in a slightly different direction. Really, I was only talking about this notion of deprogramming, that you can just take people and mold them into whatever you want by exposing them to whatever ideas, that you can just propagandize people into believing whatever you want, that people have no agency of their own. Now, of course, reason and just common sense would suggest that there are many people out there who will just believe whatever they're told and look kind of like doe-eyed into the TV like, oh my God, of course, how could I have not seen it before? But there are always those people who are skeptical by nature. There are those people who are philosophical by nature. And given a open society, given, at the risk of using a dangerous phrase, a free marketplace of ideas, those skeptical people will eventually, some of them will eventually set up their own platforms, and they will start pushing their own ideas. And then those people who are inclined to just believe whatever they're told will have the unfortunate experience of being exposed to two conflicting sets of ideas, and then they will have to decide. So while you are right, I don't think that that's the beginning and the end of the question. Now, you add this phrase when they're driven by identity and grievance. So it sounds like when you say driven by identity, you're talking about, for example, the angry white supremacist mob, let's say, of people storming the Capitol, who we're assuming, because of the sources that we've been reading, these are angry white people who are mad that they don't have power anymore, and so they want to take over the government and vote, have King Trump for the next 400 years. The House of Trump will rule America on behalf of the lily white population. So I have actually said things like this before, when they're driven by identity, that indeed making politics racial or making it identity based tends to bring out the howling murderous baboon that lives in the heart of every human, that we tend to like regress back to like an emotional amygdala in tribe out tribe kind of way of thinking when politics becomes about identity. And so really the only way to fight against that is to do what I mentioned a second ago, which is some people will be skeptical, some people will not be on board, and they should have the opportunity, because I think there should be, you know, free and open discussion. They should have the opportunity to make their case, and hopefully they can draw some people away from being driven by identity and grievance. T-Bird the Third. Hello, T-Bird the Third. Lemmings do not commit mass suicide at Shelmar. Okay, it's a metaphor. Don't act like lemmings are as silly as Americans. I have to stand up for the lemmings, you know. All right, so we'll just all agree that none of this is to say anything negative about lemmings. Fat Daddy Sambo says, I agree with Shelmar. It was said best in Men in Black that a person is smart, people are idiots. I don't think that Men in Black was the first place that that idea showed up. I think that the book The Madness of Crowds, not the Douglas Murray one, the one from 17-something, 18-something, was maybe the first to point out, though it probably goes back to, I don't know, Greek civilization, maybe the ancient Chinese said something about this, but people in a group tend to act at like, it's like the convoy travels at the speed of the slowest ship. The group acts at the intelligence level of the least intelligent person in the group. I don't know if that's really the rule, but it does seem to be the rule that individuals are a lot smarter, more measured, and more reasonable than groups are, which really, it feeds into Shelmar's point. You are correct about that. And that feeds into my argument that making politics about identity is the best way to ruin politics. Shelmar says, boomers can't shut up about China. That is true. China does seem to be everywhere these days. But of course, I'm kind of an isolationist, a proud isolationist, and I say, you know what, if China wants to rise, then China can rise if they so desire. Indeed, why we're so worried about what goes on in Asia is perhaps evidence of the very misappropriation of our attention and resources that has resulted in our relationship with China that has made the boomers so angry. Ben Brio, or Brillo, I don't know, says Trump won the election. Sleepy Joe and the Democrats rigged the election. All right, well, you're just trying to get me in trouble with this. But okay, we've talked about election stuff before. And I'll make the same argument now that I've made previously, which is this. If you believe that election fraud determined the results of the election, then the thing you need to do is to push for election reform in whatever form you think is going to be most effective. You want to get rid of mail-in ballots, let's get rid of mail-in ballots. You want to get voter ID, then fight for that. Make that your issue. You should talk about nothing else for the next 4 years. If the situation is indeed this, that Trump won the election, Sleepy Joe and the Democrats rigged the election, if you really believe that, then your issue for the next 4 years, the next 20 years, should be election reform. Because indeed, above board elections, like Plato's courage being the virtue that allows for all the other virtues, is the political issue that allows for the existence of all the other political issues. If you don't have elections, you don't have anything. We don't have a democracy anymore. We have probably a technocracy, frankly. And T-Bird says, facts, the lowest common denominator. Okay. Shomar says, these people aren't rational self-interest or some philosophical navel-gazing like in academia, but mass delusion based on personality cult, sectarianism, or race. Or they aren't driven by rational self-interest. Approaching them with a view of deprogramming is just one useful tool. Well, okay, so maybe I have to back off a little bit and say maybe deprogramming, depending on who's using the word, can be more or less scary. Perhaps if you, Shelmar, are deprogramming people with your notions you've highlighted here about identity politics being dangerous to rational discourse, maybe that would not be quite so frightening as to see people in the mainstream media talking about it. So let me rephrase that. When people in the mainstream media who I really don't trust, because I really don't trust the mainstream media or politicians just generally, and I think it's healthy to do that. I think everybody should do that. But when they start talking about deprogramming, it takes on a distinctly Orwellian air, one that makes me very nervous. And Ben Brillo says there's no way to prove the election was rigged or not rigged due to mail-in ballots. Okay, I think it is rigged due to the amount of hate Trump receives from the Democrats when he's doing a very good job. Mail-in ballots shouldn't have been used. So it sounds to me like, if you're going to take my advice, your issue for the next 4 years, if not longer, should be just one issue. Get rid of mail-in ballots, and you fight for that. And I would encourage you to go to Detroit or Philadelphia or any of the other cities that people like you have accused of having rigged elections. Go get a job as a vote counter. Fight for justice where you best see fit. T-Bird the Third, and these are the last, we're just going to read a couple more here because I want to get to my last story while there is still time. So how about I just don't trust the votes counted when half the observers was kicked out, and that being when Biden won. I completely understand. We talked about that on this show. I have said repeatedly, this election does not, seems fishy. But my first point of wisdom, the thing that I hold kind of most dear, is the idea that I know that my own knowledge is limited. I know that I know nothing, right? He is wisest, said Socrates, who knows that his wisdom counts for nothing. And I named the show Socratic Citizen because I might have a bit of a high opinion of Socrates. So I can't say for sure because I wasn't there. I can't investigate it. You're talking about layer after layer of secrecy and hiding and so on and so forth. So who knows? I can't say it doesn't look good. Doesn't look great. So really, I would be in favor of just investigating. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh my God, I know for a fact Biden stole the election, because that's dangerous to latch onto an idea like that. When all you really have are little bits and pieces of evidence. And you have to look at, for example, the fact that these claims were kicked out of court 60 plus times. In other words, you have to say, not only was the election rigged, the court system was rigged to protect the rigged election. So we've got like increasing concentric layers of conspiracy here. And you have to get to the point where it's like, basically, you take this idea to the logical conclusion, to its logical conclusion, you start getting into a little bit of like lunacy land where the CIA has pictures of Chief Justice John Roberts having sex with children. And so now he's refusing to hear the election claims when, like, Occam's razor would say, let's look at this and let's say, hey, maybe they just didn't do a good job of proving the election fraud claim because there's not a ton of evidence of it. Enough for someone like me to say, this doesn't look good. What is all this stuff? But not enough to say conclusively, oh my God, this is stolen. Let's burn down America. So Ben Brillo says, that is my issue. I'm going to fight to become president one day. Well, good luck with that. Indeed, I hope that you do, because for purely selfish reasons, I will be able to say that the president was on my show at least once. T-Bird says four court cases saying they got thrown out. That's not even up for debate. They got to watch them recount the ballots, not check signatures or ballots. Well, I will refer you to my previous comments, both because I think my previous comments address what you've just said, and because I want to talk about Nazis and Banana Republics, which is the title of this episode. So let's go into our last segment. We will read comments one more time before the end of this episode. But for right now, I want to take a look at this, which is from The Nation. Now, The Nation, being a relatively liberal publication, has been rather loose with the word fascism over the last 4 years, which I think personally is something of a mistake. But as Samuel Moyne writes here yesterday in The Nation, allegations of fascism distract from the real danger. So I have this and one other piece I want to look at about kind of the Trump legacy. And this other piece is very exciting. It really brings up something that I had not really thought of, but is very cool. And so I'm hoping that none of you had thought of it either. And so it will be equally interesting to you. But first, we have to look at this. So the absolute height of fascism talk in recent U.S. history took place at the beginning of June, in the aftermath of George Floyd's killing. It occurred amid America's largest ever popular mobilization against white supremacy and racist police violence. Allegations of fascism inadvertently testified to the possibility of change. It had been generations since so many people demanded an end to American state brutality. Those same charges of fascism, however, helped or provided no help in effecting that transformation. This is a very good point. It is undeniable that Donald Trump's presidency gave the notion of fascism cultural prominence in American politics. This goes back to, I think it was either T-Bird III or Ben was talking about Democrats really hated Trump, despite, as you guys said, him doing a good job. They repeatedly referred to him as a fascist and as his supporters as fascists and as Donald Trump's rise as the rise of fascism. But where is it? Well, here, we can at least look at this. This shows nothing that Trump actually did sparked the discourse, right? Trump didn't actually do a lot of fascist things. And of course, people on the left, who will no doubt enter and leave this chat repeatedly, will say, oh, but he put children in cages. But I am inclined to hold with the argument that the children were already in cages when he took office. And so if we're calling Trump fascist, that means that we have to call a lot of other American presidents fascists as well. And so I hold with this idea. Nothing Trump actually did really merits the designation of fascist, unless one counts the rhetorical fuel, the article says, he added to the fire of outrage and violence set off in Virginia by several hundred punks. So, unless one counts the rhetorical fuel he added to the fire, this goes back to something I had said before and that I still believe, which is that Trump really did not change much. What Trump really did was bring to the forefront things that were already boiling under the surface. The pot was already boiling. Trump merely came along and took the lid off. And we looked at all the steam coming out and said, oh my God, Trump, what have you done? You've turned things up to a boiling point. All he really did was expose these points, this kind of boiling undercurrent in American culture and politics that already existed. So, the fascism frame was a choice that activists, commentators, and politicians made, and June 2020 proved it again and conclusively. No comparable talk, especially about Barack Obama, happened in response to the police slaying of Michael Brown on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. So the question is, why did we make that choice, i.e. the choice to use the word fascism? And remember, this is a left-wing publication talking to left-wing people saying, should we continue to refer to Trump and Trumpists as fascism and fascists? And are there better ones now? So asking them, this is probably important to note, is not to deny that America experienced a kind of fascism during the Jim Crow era. that fascism in one of its varieties across the world could return, that America could host it, or even that fascism is latent so long as injustice lasts. Now, see, this is one of the problems here, because like I was working through both Mark Bray's History of Antifa, and I guess Mark Bray is actually a prominent figure with people who identify with Antifa, and he refers to the Robert O. Paxton book, Anatomy of Fascism, and Paxton has, I think, written a couple books on the history of fascism. But the problem here is that fascism is such a tricky term to nail down. It's really not clear what it means, and this, like the relative obscurity of certain Bible verses, has very much lent itself to people using fascism to mean whatever they want it to mean. Like, when I was a kid, fascism meant being like a German with a swastika armband who hated the Jews and wanted to take over Europe. Well, I guess that's Nazi, but and then being a fascist meant being the Italian sidekicks of the guys with swastika armbands who wanted to take over Europe. It meant hyper-nationalism. It meant like genocidal racism. Really, really, and it was a really intense, extreme philosophy. But nowadays, it seems like fascism can refer to being somebody who thinks the United States should be a Christian nation, which doesn't strike me as fascistic. Like, you can be conservative, you can be right-wing without being fascistic, right? Because fascism is fascism and National Socialism are the twin ideologies of the Axis powers of World War II in Europe, right? And you look at those ideologies, it's really not clear what they believed. And I think even Mussolini was quoted as saying, our ideology is the fist of power. They really said, look, just give us power. We'll figure out what we're actually going to do later. It's about the imagery. It's about this mythology of the nation. It doesn't really clearly lend itself to any particular policy prescriptions. And indeed, you see Mussolini's transition from 1919 up through World War II. He goes from emphasizing the social part of the National Social melding together to the national part. He moves from a socialist to a corporatist. And indeed, I was reading yesterday, the Italian term for fascism is Stato Corporativo, state corporatism. So it's really not clear what fascism actually is. In other words, it's a very, very murky concept. So that's why I am inclined against using terms like fascism to talk about Trump, or really to use it at all. I think we'd be better off to just excise the word fascism and let's call things what they are, because fascism is too murky. It's too unclear what it actually means. It can mean a bunch of different things depending on whether you're in Hungary or Germany or Italy or the United States. So let's take a look here, because we've only got a couple minutes and I still want to read all of these lovely comments that I see here. So this is from N+1 magazine. It's called The Hour of the Barbarian. And we have a picture here of a barbarian. But this guy is not the barbarian that the headline is talking about. He's just a particularly barbaric looking fellow. So soon after Trumpists stormed the United States Capitol last Wednesday, politicians, entertainers, and brands began to weigh in. A theme emerged. Quote, this is how election results are disputed in a banana republic, not our democratic republic, tweeted George W. Bush. Bush should know that the original banana republics were the intentional creation of Washington foreign policy and North American corporations, most famously the United Fruit Company. And because I've got only a little time, I'm just going to summarize here. This article points out something that I kind of had like latent in the back of my brain, in the dark part of my mental mind, but that was brought to the forefront by this guy pointing it out, that Americans have engaged in imperialism now for a long time, most notably for the last 70 years since the end of World War II, but probably with things like the Monroe Doctrine for much longer in a kind of more latent form, and specifically with the things like the United Fruit Company in the early parts of the 20th century. And so this article argues that all of the barbarism that imperialism requires, all of the barbaric practices that imperialism requires to force countries to adopt these kind of united fruit or giant corporations sympathetic governments, governments that are more willing to take the money of American corporations than they are to refuse the money of American corporations in pursuit of defending the rights and well-being of their own citizens. This has come home to roost, and that we're starting to see in the United States the kind of things that have happened in other countries for years, that most of these revolutions that we think of as happening in banana republics were largely happening because they were perpetrated by the imperial fingers of U.S. foreign policy. And that it's no surprise that we should start to see it here, that the barriers between the beautiful inside the United States and the scary, weird other outside the United States has really been broken down by imperialism. And these, what we saw in the Capitol was indeed just the fruits of imperialism coming home to roost, which I think is very interesting. So if you're going to use the word fascism, this is it. Really, government making these deals with private companies for the benefit of the owners of those companies, feeding people lines of whether it's patriotism and religion, or whether it's equality and having a certain number of women and brown faces in your cabinet, to distract them from the fact that really the government operates at the behest and on behalf of the largest companies in the United States. That is, if anything, is real fascism. So let's read some comments here, and then we'll bring this to a close. So look at all this good stuff. So let's see what's going on here. T-Bird the Third says Trump personally rounded up every single immigrant child and threw them in cages. Yes, Trump does show a surprising athleticism for someone of his age, which is no doubt required if one's going to be rounding up every single immigrant child. It's true, I swear, CNN told me so. Well, we all trust CNN around here. Shalmar says, I'm calling for the complete shutdown of Muslims entering the U.S. seemed a bit fascist to me. I will agree that it seems fascist, but I don't think that it is fascist. Fascism does not have a monopoly on suspicion of Islam, nor does it have a monopoly on xenophobia. And you see now, maybe with the two articles I put together here, what I was trying to say about Nazis and banana republics, or fascists and banana republics. What fascism, if anything is fascism, what fascism really is, and what is a distraction. So T-Bird says there never was, though the ban didn't restrict all Muslims, but Muslims from conflict zones. Trump speaks in hyperbole. And then Shalmar replies, speaking in hyperbole, LOL, that was his official stance for months. Okay, so I think the kind of middle ground here, where we can all just say this is reality, is to say Trump definitely does speak in hyperbole. That is undeniable. So perhaps to take Trump at his word is never really a good policy. You're going to end up with a pretty horrifying approximation of Trump's worldview and his desires and policies if you take him at his word. My rule is take whatever he says and divide by 10. If he says, I have the best words, okay, divide by 10. If he says, it's going to be billions of dollars, that means it's going to be millions of dollars. If he says, I'm the richest guy in America, that means he's in the top 100 richest people in America. So on and so forth. So this whole thing about there was a ban on Muslims from conflict zones, what you're talking about is the divergence between Trump's messaging on the so-called Muslim ban versus the reality of it. Right? Because I could be a Muslim from Russia and I could enter the United States, no problem. I could be a Muslim from South Africa or even Mexico and still enter the United States. It was specifically supposed to be Muslims from conflict zones, but the way Trump sold it to the American people, beyond just the specifics of what he said, the way he sold it overall made it seem like it was about Islam. He was not a precise enough he was not precise enough in his messaging to make it clear that it wasn't about Muslims. It was supposed to be about Muslims from conflict zones, right? And I don't know that Trump himself really ever made that distinction, because, I mean, say what you want about him, he thought in very broad strokes, all right? That's, I don't think we can deny that. So Mythos TV, hello Mythos, says Mussolini believed in the cultural supremacy. Yeah, he wanted to resurrect the Roman Empire, if I believe. So T-Bird says, now you are actually off. Italians and fascists was less about race. They didn't care about Jews. Germany did. Yes, I remember reading this in Paxton's book, where it was kind of weird that Mussolini was like best buds, butt buds with Hitler, and Hitler was all about the Jews, and Mussolini actually had Jews working with him, and he had financial backers who were Jews. And so there was this very awkward kind of position where Mussolini's standing behind Hitler going, yeah, but at the same time, he goes home and hangs out with all of his Jewish friends. So kind of a weird situation there, but that does feed into, T-Bird, exactly what I was saying. Fascism is a murky idea. But if it means anything, it means handing over control of things that should be the purview of we the people, or we the people of other countries, they the people, and handing them over to private companies and forcing them at the point of a gun. So I don't like to use fascism, but if we're going to use it for anything, I would argue let's use it for that. Shalmar says the worries were about authoritarianism and white nationalism. For example, Trump posed a threat to the ideals of impersonal rule, demanding personal loyalty of his cabinet, nepotism, etc. His support among the alt-right, which he never disavowed explicitly, his use of fake news, rhetoric, and so on. And you've got more here. I'm just going to read all of it. Doesn't make him a fascist, does make the worries about authoritarianism by hyperventilating liberals contain a grain of truth. Ha ha, in all capitalist states, the government acts on the benefit of its largest firms. The two are objectively linked by the logic of national and capitalist competition. Imperialism is just the militarization of that competition. That certainly is not fascist by itself. Well, I suppose we're getting into the area of definitional disputes, where you say, well, capitalism, really what you're talking about is capitalism, not fascism. So we can just kind of sit here and banter back and forth about definitions all day long. Personally, I would restrict capitalism to free trade, just people exchanging stuff. And I would go with, I forget his name, he's some Harvard economist, who pointed out that capitalism was named by Marxists, that nobody was talking about capitalism until Marx came along. They might talk about capital, they might talk about trade, they might talk about industry, but the idea of capitalism as like an ideology came really from Marxist theory, at least according to this guy. And that makes sense to me, because if you really think about it, capitalism in its most like pure form is the government not really doing much and kind of just letting people do their thing. You enforce contract law. You don't let people steal from each other or kill each other. You enforce basic laws. But beyond that, you let people kind of just do whatever they want to do. Now, inequality does result. But in theory, at least, brutality should be prescribed. You should not be able to go to somebody's country and start shooting people until they agree to sell you the land that United Fruit wants to use to grow their bananas, and hence the Banana Republic. So really, I think that's a definitional dispute. We are agreed in principle that this is bad and that it goes on. So really, I had two purposes there, not just the definition of fascism, but also to point out that tendency. So at least we're agreed on the tendency part, if not on the definitions of fascism and capitalism and so on and so forth. Though I was reading about Ludwig von Mises and some of his buddies in the classical liberal camp, and I think I might have to talk a little bit about this. This seems ripe for an episode tomorrow. T-Bird says, Biden is vetting soldiers. Nepotism, you say. Funny. Now, T-Bird, let's be real. We can accuse Biden of doing bad things, and Biden no doubt has some very questionable nepotistic skeletons in his closet. Certainly Hunter Biden is not the apotheosis of upstanding individualism. Certainly not a capitalist icon, to use my definition of capitalist. But at the same time, let us not engage in whataboutism. Biden has certainly is not the picture of being above board and moral and awesome. But that does not take away from the fact that Trump did have a tendency to hire his family members as opposed to like hiring the most qualified person in the world, right? Both of those things can be true at the same time. And really, what I try to promote here is not an atmosphere of, oh, well, your side did this. Because we're really not here to be on sides. We're here to find the truth, hence Socratic citizen. So you are right. But at the same time, that doesn't really change the Trump thing. T-Bird says it literally is, though, because fascism is the merger of state and big business. All right, so we got, I'm confirmed now. The next episode, tomorrow's episode, for the first segment, we're going to talk about fascism, imperialism, and capitalism, where the lines are, what each one is, and whether, I think this is going to have to come up, whether capitalism necessarily deteriorates into a kind of fascistic imperialism, as many liberals like to argue. So we will be back tomorrow because we are at the end of our hour and capitalism is still king and I have been brutalized and oppressed into still having a day job. We will be back here tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time as we are every weekday. And to answer your question, Mythos, welcome to the show. So, yeah, we are here every weekday, 9 to 10 a.m. You can find our archive on YouTube if you can't catch the show live. You can go find, we save them here on Twitch. They are also here on YouTube and on DLive, by the way, if you like DLive. And because I'm paranoid about being censored all the time. So we'll talk about that tomorrow, as well as our usual slew of quick takes on funny articles and then some other interesting topic of my choosing. So leave us comments on YouTube or Twitch if you can't catch the show live. We always read the best comments at the beginning of the show as well. So thank you very much for joining us. We will be back here tomorrow. This has been another episode of Socratic Citizen.